So the discourse that we've been discussing this week presents a path or a sequence, an unfolding, that ends in liberation. And so today's talk is the end of that sequence, is with liberation. And I find myself with kind of mixed feelings about talking about this topic. The most strongest one at the moment is a certain degree of reverence and care in the in discussing the topic. It seems like it's a very important topic, and because of some abstract idea of Buddhism, but rather because talking about a possibility for you, possibility for your heart and mind, that it's such an important potential that I don't know, just, you know, it touches on something that can be central to a person's life or very important. And that's a strong feeling. The other feeling I had, especially early in the day thinking about that this is what the talk I was going to give, I felt a little bit like, I felt it was a little bit humorous or something. I was kind of amused by it, how do you prepare for a talk about liberation? You know, it just felt like if I prepared for it, that's not liberation. You know, just like liberation's not about anything. It's more immediate than that. So just, you know, so, and then I thought, well, you know, I could get nervous and then get motivated to make notes, and but that's even further away from it. And so do I just show up unprepared? Is that the best thing to do if you're going to talk about liberation? You know, so I felt, oh, well, I don't know. What a funny position to be in. So this discourse that we've been talking about is is similar to many other places in the teachings of the Buddha, where the Buddha presents his teachings in a fashion that kind of follows a progression. And one place he very explicitly said that he teaches a gradual path or a gradual process, and so step by step. One place he talks about the gradualness of the path as being where what he knew about was the ocean floor, when you leave the coast, gets deeper very slowly. So probably you can walk out quite far because it just slowly goes deeper and deeper. And so like that kind of ocean bottom that slowly gets deeper, so this path slowly goes deeper. But it takes walking it. It takes walking to go find the depth. It takes being on it. And it's something very, I think, human about seeing the spiritual life as being following a developmental model, that developmental model of growth. That is, we know, is how humans often develop and grow. And we talk about developmental models for the growth of children. Children go up and they mature over those 18, 21, 36 years, 48 years that it takes to grow up. 82 years. Some of you are still waiting. You know, but it's a developmental model, and you expect it that different, you know, that as they grow, as their synapses form and the hormones happen and intelligence happens and life experience happens and all these things happen, that they develop and grow. And we expect it to be some, you know, sequential. And there's no reason why it has to stop when you're 18, But that developmental can keep developing to a much greater degree. And so we can talk about spiritual development into adulthood, or in the Buddhist terminology, developing those inner qualities and capacities that support us so that we can become liberated, become free. And so the Buddha often has this developmental model that he presents the texts in, and sometimes implicit, sometimes quite explicit. And what's unusual about this text is how much this the path, the developmental path, is placed in the context of our civic life, our social life. And many places you read, like the classic text, foundational text for our Vipassana movement, is the Satipatthana Sutta, the Discourse on the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. And you have to kind of squeeze it hard to get relational issues out of that text. You can maybe, if you squeeze hard enough, you can get water out of gravel. But maybe if you squeeze this one hard enough and look at it certain ways, you can get something relational out of it. But it's kind of not really this what comes out first and foremost in this text. And in fact, not a few people have come to IMC and said, you know, I go there and I sit and meditate with my eyes closed, and you give a talk and I go home and I don't talk to anybody. And the relational doesn't so obvious sometimes in some of the ways that the teachings are presented. And but here it's very clear that so much of what's being presented is in the context of our civic life, our social life. And I think it's important to realize how much that we're homo civicus. who we are as human beings is we're very much social beings. Even if you're an introvert who likes living in a cabin far off in the wilderness, that lifestyle, that life probably is happening in relationship to other people in some way or other. And as we grow up, starting from as soon as you're born, even before you're born, there's a relationship. There's hopefully a nurturing cocoon, womb that you're in, and that's a safe place, a nice place. And you come out of that womb, and you're pretty helpless. And the only thing, one of the few things you can maybe do for yourself is you can cry and to get some attention. And they're pretty good at it, these babies. They seem to know how to cry just right, to pull all the strings in the parents' hearts. Who's in control? The crier is. And we come out pretty helpless as human beings when we're born, and so we really depend on others to care for us. And you wouldn't be here today unless there were people who cared for you, did everything for you at some point. And then slowly you can do more things for yourself, and so there's a slow process of becoming more self-reliant. But this need for contact, for support, for mirroring, for people who can be seen by others. I mean, we're so learning how to be a human being is a very complex phenomenon, and no one comes with a manual. I wish they had given me a manual when I started being a parent. How can this be legal? I thought, how can this be legal that they let me be a parent? this is more complicated than driving a car, and that I needed a license for. But so here we are, so it's a complicated thing that goes on, and it's one of the things I learned from being a teacher. Is talking to a lot of people, is that one of the really core, very powerful forms of suffering for a person continues into adulthood, they carried with them, is when as a child they were not seen. Someone didn't see them. And so then no one met them. No one could see them. No one could mirror them back. No one could support them or appreciate them or showed them that they're lovable or that they're valuable or important or a variety of things. And because it seems developmentally that's something that's needed as we're growing up. And so that then continues into adulthood. That need is still there, it doesn't go away, but then it plays out in all kinds of different ways. We're homo civicus. We're so deeply, you know, the social connections and who we are. And it's easy to come to Buddhism and kind of, to confuse some of these Buddhist teachings as being support for not being in relationship, because it seems like it's saying just non-attachment. So, let's not care, and let's not, you know, let go of it all. Or there's no self-teaching. Some people's wound around self is they feel they don't count, they feel unworthy, and so they just love Buddhism. Boy, they feel justified. They're home. Yes, I'm not here. I don't count. Finally, someone validates it for me. But that's not healthy, right? That's not good. So what I'm trying to say is, you know, the idea of being social, civic, connected to others, and this whole social dimension is built into our evolutionary biology in a very, very deep way. And so how do we relate to it? How do we work with it? How do we include it as part of the developmental process of growing up, becoming free? And so this text is one of the few places in the suttas that kind of lays out a path for that, where it talks about some of the attitudes, some of the mental behaviors that we have that are very relational, have a big role in how we relate to other people, that can make those relationships go askew, make them painful and difficult. And an instruction to pay attention to that and get to know them. And then it also talks about the relationship of faith and confidence. Where do you have faith in? What do you have confidence in? What do you have trust in? And this is a relational thing. Some people might have trust in a confidence in a parent when they're young, or a grandparent, or an aunt or uncle, or a neighbor or something. One person I know, it wasn't until they went to school, and sometime, I think like in seventh grade, there was one teacher who believed in her, who would listen to and talk with her, and you know, that made a huge difference in her life. So who do you have confidence in? Who do you have trust in? Who trusts you? Has confidence in you? So this whole confidence thing is a relational thing. And so here, it's in the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha. And I imagine when this text was composed, the story, you know, was back in the time of the Buddha, you know, that was a real person. You know, the person who expressed their confidence in the Buddha was like, you, you know. You know, it wasn't some person that popped out of a book. And then, the Brahma Viharas. You know, these beautiful, beautiful, heartfelt emotions. Are they unnatural? Are they artificial to feel loving kindness and compassion? Or probably not. I think they're kind of, for most people, and I wouldn't say everyone, I think that, there's a human instinct towards compassion, human instincts towards kindness and love. And it's kind of needed for these little babies that cry. You know, the whole system works if they care for them and want to support them. This whole relational world is quite important. And it's not to be dismissed or denied or disrespected or considered second best. You know, like, well, this is okay, but I think it's, you know, embedded in this text. Um, begins with the Buddha saying, bhikkhus, he's talking to his monastics, and they say to him, venerable sir, and then he spoke to them. It begins with this relationship, begins with this teaching relationship, where he calls their names, calls them, and they reply, yes. So it's a relational world that's going on here. We mustn't forget how important this is. And this text ends with liberation. And one of my favorite, maybe it's called epithets, or kind of words, that single word that kind of defines or describes title for an arhat, someone who's fully awakened, fully liberated, is a person is an akinshano. And akinshano means, literally means nothing, no thing. Kinshino means like thing, and is a negative here, so nothing. So I like that. And but you know, how does being nothing relate to this deep relational world that we're part of? And how do we be nothing? How is that important in a way that doesn't dismiss the relational world? Sometimes the commentaries say this nothing means that you're no longer tied to your possessions. So monks, none doesn't have many possessions, so it doesn't have much. But I think at a more profound level, it's there's something psychologically about having nothing, and what is it that we can have that is worthwhile not having, of letting go of. And so one of the things that's worthwhile not having anymore is clinging, is craving, is addiction, is holding tight. It's not worth it. And some of the things that we cling to, maybe those are not worth clinging to in and of themselves. Perhaps there's something about those things that they don't even exist, but except in a figment and constructions of our own minds. And so, do we understand what our minds does? I had a very important experience for me when I was in Japan at the monastery, where I spent 5 months living with mostly young Japanese monks, and we did everything together. We slept all in the same room, we ate together all together, we worked together, we did everything, took breaks together. So in Japan is a very they call it collectivist culture. So, very much the group is important. And every morning we had Sangha service, like we had here. The difference between Sangha service there and Sangha service at the Zen monastery, here and there, is that there, the work had to be done vigorously. And it's like full board, 60 miles an hour, just like you take this cloth and you're rushing around and, you rush from one. We had to remember in the Buddha hall, we had to clean these columns that held up the ceiling, and you had to clean one column, rush over to the next one, clean the next one, and there were all these groups of monks doing the same thing, and what was important was cleaning, not that it needed to be cleaned. So I'd finish cleaning one column, and I'd go to the next one, and then someone would take my column and clean it again. What was important was cleaning, doing, and so. So then at some point, maybe 3-4 months into this, I'd been there long enough, and I kind of had a certain kind of waking up experience in the middle of doing this, very fast collective work, or everybody working. And somehow I realized that I lived in a different social universe than they did. And the best way I can explain this is that my universe was I was an individual working in a room with other individuals. So that's how I saw myself. I was an individual who was part of a group. They saw themselves as a group within which they were an individual. What was first was the group identity. They saw themselves first as a collective. And that's how they saw each other and how they operated. And you can kind of, once I saw that, I said, oh yeah, they're tuned in that way, and how they operate, how they, what they do. It's like, seems very much, it's kind of, it's like all the little cues about how they're relating to each other are based on a different premise. And when I saw that, I didn't think one was right and one was wrong. But I think, you know, it's just different ways of society, people organizing themselves to get through the day. We have to figure out some way to get through the day with each other. And so it's just different ways. And they may be able, each way has its strengths and its weaknesses. But what struck me was that there are different ways. And only then did I become aware that the way that I had been raised, the cultural way that I'd been culturated, was just one way of being conditioned, just one way of understanding who I was and what society was. And I was kind of flabbergasted by that. I thought that, you know, my sense of self, who I am, is, this is just the truth. You know, this is just the way things are. And I never, you know, it's like they say, the fish doesn't see the water it swims in. I hadn't seen the culturally conditioned notions of self that I was living in, because it was just everyone else had the same one here in America, so that I had contact with. And so, you know, it was just obvious, this is the way it was. But by being in Japan, I saw, oh, it's not that way. It's different ways. It's culturally conditioned. And then I saw when I was raising my son, at some point when he was about 2 years old, I saw that I was making choices how to relate to him, that I was passing on my cultural understanding of what it means to be a self. Certain assumptions I had of what a, you know, or I don't know, I wouldn't say a right self, but you know, I was helping him develop a sense of self. And I wonder, is this right? I think so.